Welcome to this podcast from the September 8, 2014 meeting of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. This podcast was recorded in Washington, D.C. and is from the first session with a presentation from Brian Hainline, Chief Medical Officer of the NCAA. Dr. Hainline became the NCAA's first Chief Medical Officer in January 2013. He oversees the NCAA Sports Science Institute, whose mission is to promote and develop safety, excellence, and wellness in college student athletes and to foster lifelong physical and mental development. This session features a discussion of the NCAA's Concussion Research Project, new medical care guidelines, and future health and safety initiatives. This session lasts approximately 1 hour and 6 minutes. For more information on the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics, please visit knightcommission.org.
Well, thank you very much for having me here, and it really is a pleasure and an honor. I'm going to be speaking in broad strokes, trying to let you know some of the health and safety issues that we've been trying to come to understand and to work through since I started at the NCAA. I wanted to begin with how I got involved with the NCAA. I've been in sports medicine for over 20 years at the level of being a ringside doc or working with the USOC or being very involved in doping issues, and also being very involved with one of the loves of my life, the sport of tennis. And I was actually the chief medical officer for the U.S. Open for 16 years as well. But when I interviewed for the job, a job I wasn't sure I wanted and one that I didn't need, but it was kind of at an interesting time of my life. And there were two things I noted in the interview that I think are particularly important and really drive 90% of what I do today. And what I said is that I don't think there are really issues with the NCAA per se. I think that the NCAA is a product of our society, and we have to look at our society and the continuum that moves to the NCAA. And there were two things in particular that I addressed. One is the increasing physical illiteracy in our country among our children. And it really has become rather devastating when we compare it to other countries in the developed world. At the time I interviewed, we were the most obese country on the planet. We were surpassed last summer by Mexico. But it's still shameful what is happening to our grade school, high school, college kids, and beyond. And the other thing I addressed was that despite that, there's a paradox in youth sport. You would think that would be what would help us to solve the physical illiteracy, but it's a broken model. Youth sport has become something in which we are over-specializing at a young age despite all of the data that tell us that is the wrong thing to do. It's the wrong thing to do for the human being. It's the wrong thing to do for the athlete. And it leads to overuse injuries and burnout. And overuse injuries are perhaps the most serious issue facing our kids today. So those were the broad strokes. I began my work in January 2013, and I'll cut right to the chase about one thing. In all of the positions that I've held over the years, I don't believe I've ever been as welcomed as I have been at the NCAA, not just by the full-time professional staff and Dr. Emmert making certain that I was interwoven with everything that happened there, but more importantly by the member institutions. When I go to visit, and I visited numerous schools, numerous conferences, there's just an incredible sense of welcoming. But I think that's driven in part by something that's happening. And that's that there's a collective sense of desperation out there. The desperation is about the broken model that we have in youth sport going through college sport. The desperation is about what we're doing in our country, about ensuring the health and well-being of all of our children and all of our young adults. And I think what the NCAA offers, it's a name brand recognition that isn't here to solve the problem, but is here to at least build bridges with everyone so that together, collectively, as a society, we can solve the problem. So I knew going into this that despite everything that I might look at and say, well, let's address this, let's address that, the elephant in the room was concussion. And that if I succeeded at everything other than concussion, that the job of chief medical officer would be considered a failure. So that really was the vast majority of what I did for the first year and a half. And one of the first things I did was I reached out to the Department of Defense. And you might ask why, but the facts are that the Department of Defense funds more traumatic brain injury research than any institution in the world. And if we look at traumatic brain injury and concussions from our military men and women, more than 85% of them happen in a way that is identical to a sports-related concussion. Less than 15% are from blast injuries, which is a different pathophysiology altogether. So there's something that we have in common. But one thing the NCAA has that the military theater does not have and that emergency rooms do not have is we have a fairly well-controlled population. So it presents an opportunity to come to understand this condition. So after innumerable meetings, really meeting with the leading scientists from around the world, but especially within this country, we had a magical meeting in December, last December in Washington, D.C. It was a round table or a rectangle table like this, 20 leading scientists, about half from NCAA member institutions, half from the Department of Defense. And we asked ourselves this question. If you had $30 million to solve the concussion problem, what would you do? And after 3 hours of thoughtful discussion led by Colonel Hack and myself, there was a universal consensus in the room that to date, we do not understand the natural history of concussion. And let me repeat that. We do not understand the natural history of concussion. The prospective longitudinal study has never been done. The largest clinical studies perhaps have 30 concussions in them. So that was one conclusion. The other conclusion was that we have no evidence whatsoever that educational interventions change perceived norms or behavior with regard to the stakeholders in concussion. Our education is ineffective. So what we concluded after that meeting was that we should focus on two things. One is developing a clinical prospective longitudinal study on concussion, and two, launching an educational grand challenge to try to understand how to change the behavior of concussion. And I'm happy to say that both are in motion. 2 weeks ago, we started that prospective study. And let me tell you what we're doing. In year one, we're working with 14 member institutions. And there are about 500 to 1,000 kids at each of these schools. They will all be participating in the concussion study through a HIPAA IRB-informed consent. And this is what will happen. Every kid, not just the football players and not just the males, we're going to try to understand what happens to females too. And no one's talking about that. Every single kid will undergo the same baseline exam. And it's a very detailed exam that's based on the best evidence out there. And then after every concussive event, that exam will be repeated within 6 hours, again within 48 hours, and then consecutively going to 6 months, and then the exam will be repeated every year. By the end of 3 years, we will have studied close to 40,000 student athletes. All of the data are going into the same database, and the study is being run by three centers. And I received numerous applications for who could be running this study. One is Indiana University. They're doing the administrative part and the biostatistical analysis. University of Michigan is overseeing the clinical study. And Medical College of Wisconsin, the advanced research core part of the study. We are going to have, after the end of this, probably we will have looked at least 600 concussions. That's a conservative estimate. In addition, starting this year, we're rolling out with three schools, and then it's going to expand over the next 3 years. We're looking at three sports in particular during year one: football, men's and women's lacrosse, and men's and women's soccer. And next year, we're going to be looking at men's and women's ice hockey. In these sports, these kids will be getting a baseline MRI. They're going to all be wearing head sensors when they're practicing and when they're in the game. They're going to have baseline blood work, genetic testing, and after every concussive event, they will have repeat MRIs and blood biomarker studies that will again go on consecutively, beginning within a few hours of concussion and going until 6 months, and then to be repeated every year. By the end of 3 years, we will have looked at, in great detail, 1,200 student athletes. What is really cool about this study is that we're linking the MRI study to another study going on at UCSF, which is called TRAC-TBI, and this study is ingenious and simple. Every single person in this study, it's an emergency room-based study, not only are the MRI protocols harmonized, but the MRI machines are. So when you're looking at quantitative MRI imaging, you're comparing apples and apples and not apples with oranges or apples with broccoli. That's one part of the concussion study. The second part, and we're launching this in October, we already put out the announcement 2 weeks ago. It's called the Mind Matters Educational Grand Challenge. That's going out to all 1,100 schools to say, what is the best way to develop methodology scientifically proven which will change the behavior of concussion? And I want to show you, this is a very busy slide, and I don't want to get into it in great detail, but I want to just point out a couple of things. You see at the very top, there's what's called the Executive Committee. The Executive Committee is three people. It's myself from the NCAA, Colonel Dallas Hack from the Department of Defense, and Walter Koroshetz, who's the Deputy Director of the NIH. We do not have voting power, but we are overseeing this from a broad level. The study is being run by an operating committee or a consortium that is from member institution investigators, which include either athletic trainers or scientists or neurologists or physicians. And they are the ones who are running with this study, and they're being advised by a scientific advisory panel. And in this clinical study, in year one, which has started, these are the schools that we're rolling it out to. University of Michigan, Nebraska, Princeton, Wisconsin. Next year, Wisconsin, we're going to be doing the in-depth study as well with the sensors. University of Georgia, Florida, UNC Chapel Hill, University of Pittsburgh. UNC Chapel Hill, we're starting in year one. They're doing the advanced research study. University of Washington, UCLA, they're doing the advanced research study. Oklahoma, and then Virginia Tech, they're only doing the advanced research part of the study this year, and they're already well ahead of the curve in this. And then we have three of our military academies, possibly a fourth. This is all happening year one. One of the advantages with working with the service academies is that starting in year two, we not only will be looking at the NCAA student athletes, but every single service academy member, because they're boxing year round and doing other sports year round. So we should have incredible data. And then on the other side of this slide, and I won't go through it too much, is it's just the educational part of the grand challenge. Again, that's being led by a consortium as well. The reason why we set it up this way is because we want to take away any perceived conflict of interest. I don't have voting power on this. After all of the work, I was able to let it go, almost like giving birth, or maybe almost like sending your kid off to college, or maybe after the kid graduates from college. Then there are really no strings, hopefully. But this is on its way. The other thing we set up with concussion while this was happening is that we put together a conference in January. It was co-hosted by the College Athletic Trainer Society and the NCAA. It was called a Football Practice Safety Summit. We have to focus on football. Concussion's the elephant in the room. Football is sitting on top of that elephant. But let me tell you, football is not the issue that we should always be focusing on. Our internal data tell us that the highest incidence of concussion is in men's wrestling, followed by women's ice hockey and women's field hockey. We need to think about that. And again, I'll say this again, we need to start thinking about women. They concuss differently than men. Their brains are different, and I'm not saying that from a mathematical or scientific point of view. Their pathophysiology is different, just as they are at a much increased risk of migraine during that age. There's a great similarity in migraine pathophysiology to concussion as well. So there are things that happen differently. We need to understand that. But what we did set up is we came up with guidelines that we announced in July. And very briefly, the guidelines were reducing year-round football practice contact. We had new concussion guidelines, which also included return to learn. And we had independent medical care guidelines which said that a team physician and athletic trainer have unchallengeable authority to make medical decisions. The coach is not to be involved. These were not legislation. I was criticized that this wasn't legislation. But let me tell you, it took 2 years to get CPR coaching legislation passed at the NCAA, which is a bottom-up organization. It's not a top-down organization. But what we did do, which was unique, is that in these guidelines, we had 11 medical organizations endorse them. 11. Let me name some of them for you. The American Academy of Neurology, which has never done anything like this. The American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine, the American Osteopathic Academy for Sports Medicine, National Athletic Trainers Association, College Athletic Trainers Society, American College of Sports Medicine, American Association of Neurological Surgeons, the Congress of Neurological Surgeons, Sports Neuropsychological Society. These groups that are really telling us what makes sense in concussion. They all said, this makes sense as guidelines right now. It's the best that we can do. And that sets a cultural norm. It's not legislation. It doesn't have the teeth of legislation. But if you have a cultural norm and you don't follow that cultural norm and there is an incident, you are held liable for what is considered the best practice or guidelines of a cultural norm. That's concussion. I want to move quickly to some other areas that I also believe are important. I've gone on record saying that I do not believe concussion is the most serious medical issue. I think it's mental health and overuse injuries. We convened a mental health task force. One of the ways I work is by surrounding myself by people smarter than I am in task forces, and I listen and then I try to integrate the information. Before this task force, I looked at data that we had from other surveys we had sent out, and there was a wealth of data in there that had not been analyzed because we didn't have the bandwidth to do it. So I hired someone specifically to do that. We obtained mental health data that had never been shown before. And that blew me away, quite frankly, when looking at it. We presented this at the task force, which included scientists, psychiatrists, psychologists, coaches, administrators. During that 3-day period, I can tell you that every single person at one point in time broke down, including me, but I cry at movies and stuff too, so that doesn't really count. But some of the issues we talked about, sexual abuse, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, athlete identity syndrome, where you identify with yourself as an athlete and not as a soulful human being. Depression, anxiety. The fact that if you are injured in sport and you develop depression or anxiety, it impedes your ability to recover. Depression and anxiety impede your ability to recover from injury. We looked at sleep deprivation, how after 12 weeks you progressively deteriorate if you're sleep deprived, but you yourself perceive after 3 days that you're fine. And what does the deterioration look like? You have an increase in suicidal ideation, increase in depression, increase in anxiety, and you develop symptoms that are indistinguishable from ADHD. And what is the treatment for that in our society? Stimulants. Let's just take a great giant step back and look at where we are with sleep depression or sleep deprivation among our youth, ADHD, stimulant use, and where we're going. I'm happy to say that we already sent one chapter out just as a teaser. This is going to be an e-publication, which is coming out in 1 month. And I hired someone whose job will be to socialize this document. My goal is to make mental health as accessible in the locker room as an ACL injury or a back sprain. It should be. Right now, it's compartmentalized into something else. This book is also going to serve as a foundation for future prospective longitudinal studies. Other issues that we're looking at, cardiac health. In a 5-year period, there's going to be 45 college kids who are going to die from sudden cardiac arrest or sudden cardiac death. We have the data. It's the second leading cause of death in student athletes behind accidents. The third leading cause of death, by the way, is suicide. We have to address cardiac issues. We're having a task force. It's going to be a very contentious task force because you have people over here and over here who look at screening radically different, but we have to come to some sort of a consensus about how to move forward to address cardiac death. Two other issues, and then I will conclude this presentation. One is on doping, alcohol, and recreational drug use. We've had two task forces. We're having a retreat in December with the Competitive Safeguards Committee. What I believe we need to do is to, one, develop a deterrent policy which is rational and effective for performance-enhancing drugs, but then we have to look at recreational drugs. Our focus has been on marijuana. And yes, marijuana is an issue, and it's a serious issue. But what's happening on our college campus? Marijuana use has been steady over the years. It's about 20% no matter what division you're in. Well, D3 is a little higher. You know, they sit under the trees and stuff like that. But what's going up is extreme binge drinking. What's going up is prescription opiate use. Hopefully none of you have been at a farming party and you've not had to deal with the consequences of a farming party, and that's with a pH. Where you go in and you bring in your OxyContin and your Vicodin and your Percocet and your Valium and you put them in one hat and then you will put your stimulants in the other hat and then you'll down them with shots of tequila. That's a farming party. That's happening on our college campus. I believe that the NCAA needs to find an effective partnership with our member institutions to address a societal issue of alcohol and recreational drug abuse. I don't think that testing a championship for marijuana is the answer. Anyone knows you just stop drinking, you just stop smoking for 1 month before and you'll test negative. That's not an effective deterrence. The most ambitious project that I'm undertaking, and we just had a one-day retreat on this, and that's to address early specialization and overuse injuries. There has not been one college campus or conference visit that I have made where there has not been a universal raising of the hand by the athletic trainers when I ask the question, who believes that college student athletes are coming in broken? This isn't an NCAA issue. This is a society issue. Our kids are specializing in one sport before the age of puberty. At the age of puberty, 75% of children drop out of organized sport. There's a high rate of burnout. We are seeing overuse injuries in teenagers that we used to only see in adults. Something is wrong. And the reason why I didn't make this first and foremost is because this is going to be the most difficult task force put together. We're planning it in several stages. We're starting off at a high philosophical level, but we will get nowhere with this if we do not address this with all of our youth sport organizations, our national governing bodies, and those that are trying to change the face of youth sport. That's the plan. I plan to roll that out over 2 years. I'm hoping we'll be successful. I know there is some buy-in for this. And finally, I'll just say that the one thing we're trying to do with all of this is to make certain that we're getting centralized data collection, because I can't do this job unless we're making data-driven decisions together. And right now, that's not happening as much as I would like, but that also is a goal. So these are some of the very broad overview of what we're trying to accomplish. I'm just going to end with this slide. Our mission is to promote and develop safety, excellence, and wellness in college student athletes. I think excellence cannot be separated from safety and wellness. And we have data to support that, and the coaches are starting to listen. You want a top-performing athlete? If that athlete's depressed, he or she will not perform as well. If that athlete has disordered eating, he or she will not perform as well. The second part of our mission is to foster lifelong physical and mental development. They should not be separated. Physical and mental well-being, well, on this great planet of ours, everything we experience is physical. As a neuroscientist, I must say that. That is my statement of faith. It's a statement of science. Doesn't mean that I didn't enjoy teaching Sunday school for 20 years, which I just recently retired from because of my NCAA job. That's a different statement of faith. But on this planet of ours, we experience everything physically. We can't arbitrarily separate mental wellness from physical wellness. Our vision, to be the preeminent, to be the best in the best. But what's important in our vision statement is the last part of it, is to be the steward of best practices for youth and intercollegiate sport. We must do this together. And my job, the best thing I can do, is to be a bridge builder with all of the people we're working with. Everyone's out there trying to do the same thing. And we can build bridges not only with all of the medical organizations, not only with all of the member institutions, but with our youth sport. People understand that we need to do this. I think the time is right. And anything you all can do in support of this would be so much appreciated, because we need the strong voices to say, this is what we need to do. This is the time. This is the season. We're ready to move forward. So thank you for your attention.
Brian, thank you very, very much for that excellent presentation. I especially want to thank you for the effort you're bringing to expose and address these critical issues. A brief presentation has been a real eye-opener for me, and I'm sure my colleagues around the table. So let's throw the floor open for some discussion. Anita and then Amy.
Thank you. I guess it'd be easiest for me to just say amen. I work with kids moving up to college, and we have found the dearth of information on concussion, as well as we sought to provide some information, and even on youth football. What we've done is we have a conference, and we determined that we would not make grants to any league that had full contact with kids under age 8, which is ridiculous. They can barely, their necks are so small, they can barely hold up their heads with the helmets on anyway. But I hope that we could work together with this too, because the youth, as you point out, the youth is the beginning of the collegiate athlete, and all the things that you've said, we found are real problems in the overuse of all of that, and gathering information. So if we could get together after this, it would be very, very helpful. But thank you for what you're doing at the collegiate level, because that does, it also affects the world, because our collegiate program trains the world, as you probably know. About 10% of the athletes at the NCAA are from around the world.
Well, we have to, I think the NCAA has to set the tone. I'll tell you one of the problems with youth sport. I was sharing this information last night. You look at something like where I come from, New York City, the Public School Athletic League, 25,000 student athletes, no athletic trainers. So who is there protecting the kids? Who's gathering the data? So it's the Wild West out there. And we have to come to a way of progressively understanding how we safeguard the kids while they're out there, how we get the right information. And so there are other projects we're working on. We have a U.S. Coaches Coalition. You know, in this country, you can become a coach like I became a coach in soccer. I was a coach in soccer. I had never even seen a game of soccer in my life. And then I became coach of the traveling team because we won. I'm like, hey, guys, you know, this doesn't make sense. So we need to really take a step back and look at how we're giving information to our youth. I think it's starting to happen, but we're really at the infancy stage.
Okay, I've got Amy, then Carol, Myron, and Lynn. Oh, and then Andrew. Okay. Oh, you didn't. Okay, Carol was next.
Thank you very much for a very enlightening presentation. I wish you would go back to the behavior of concussion and tell us a little bit more about what that means. I think I'm making some assumptions about what might go on in the Education Grand Challenge, and I'd like to hear a little bit more detail from you.
So a couple of studies came out in the past year. One was from University of Pennsylvania, where we knew that all of the kids on the football team were well-educated about concussion. 42% said that if they had a concussion, they would not report it. And the reasons they wouldn't report it were things like, well, I'm infallible, or I don't want to let the team down, or I don't want to lose my position, and so forth. Then we looked at a group of schools from the other schools in the Ivy League. I wasn't involved in the study, but others were. And we looked at ice hockey players. And some of the kids, we knew they were educated about concussion. 0% remembered having received that education. So there's a lot that's out there. You know, you give pamphlets. You know, the kids are signing 20 documents within 1 minute. And so what we are trying to do, and it's a short-term and a long-term study. The short-term study is, based on the best data we have right now, give us a multimedia package, which we think will be impactful in terms of having people understand that concussion is a serious condition. It's a medical condition. It needs to be addressed. It's not to be hid, and it's not to be you're not to shortchange the recovery for it. But then there is a 3 to 5 year project in which we're giving a series of grants to actually come up with methodology similar to what was done in the addiction literature. And in that literature, we have certain things that we know will make a difference in terms of changing perceived norms. And it's tough out there because, you know, when you're in the heat of the moment, whether it has to do with addiction, whether it has to do with sexual activity, whether it has to do with return to play, when you're quiet and reflective, you can say, I would behave this way. But in the heat of the moment, you behave another way. And so these are the kinds of things that we have to address. And so the long-term study is going to be rolled out. I think it's going to take probably 4 to 5 years. We have a series of judges that are looking at this at multiple levels. And I'm hopeful about it because right now, when it comes to education, we don't know what's making a difference.
Myron?
Dr. Hanline, thank you very much for that presentation as well. And I want to applaud your organization for taking it very seriously to add you to their team. You talked a lot about the hard science behind a lot of these health issues, specifically concussions. And as a physician as you are and as a medical student as I am, one thing that we're told often is that a lot of these issues, especially concussions, is dealing with the social and cultural aspects, the social cultural determinants of the disease rather than just the hard physical science. So you touched on it briefly in your last comment, but my question to you is, would it be better served that coaches or families or people that can influence and speak into the lives of some of these student athletes are developed and shaped in a way that can kind of mitigate this issue of returning to play, family pressures, team hierarchical structures, as you said, if I'm a rookie or a freshman, you know, I don't want to let the senior down and look soft or perceive soft on the football team, or maybe even some of the gender roles specifically that are related to the concussion issues. So how do you tap in, how do you access some of these student athletes to really get them moving more towards a healthier state and kind of mitigate some of these social and cultural aspects that go behind the disease?
No, it's a great point. So we know from data that coaches are the number one influence on our young kids, our young athletes. In the educational grand challenge, actually, it's to target coaches and their perceived norms, parents, their perceived norms, as well as much as the student athletes and the other stakeholders. So that's one part of it. There are a lot of other things we're doing. I just for time's sake, I didn't mention them. But we actually rolled out as a pilot a coaches education program. And we did it in D2 schools because D2 you can experiment a little bit more with them. They like to be on the cutting edge. And so we gave it to about 100 coaches. And it was actually on the values and ethics basis of sport, on concussion education, and on doping. And then we had an independent group that looked at how effective were we in terms of the delivery and changing behavior. And we got pretty good grades, but I have to go back to the drawing board on it. It just, you know, it was a little rough around the edges. The coaches said, you know, this wasn't specific enough for us, but we want this information. And so there's a separate group where we're looking at how can we actually try to educate our coaches. I put as one of my 10-year plans that within 10 years, every coach is going to have a very, very solid background in the sports sciences. Why 10 years? Well, it's very hard to change the behavior of a coach who's been out there already for 20 years, and so we hope to start with the young coaches. It doesn't mean we're waiting for 10 years. It's just I think it's going to take a while before we really get that system in our country. And that has to start at the grade school and high school level, too. So actually, we are having these discussions with youth organizations as well. But our educational grand challenge is going to specifically address the issue of coaches and parents. Parents, you know, I think parents do what they believe is right, but they're misinformed.
Lynn?
Doc, thanks very much for your presentation. I'm really heartened by hearing you outline the focus on youth physical as well as mental well-being. I know there was a time when the NCAA was committed along those lines, and it was, you know, part their participation in a group that I was CEO of called iHoops. And at one point in time, the focus was on pretty much a lot of the things that your mission statement outlined, and then suddenly, you know, the NBA started to take over. The NCAA seemed to have lost their interest. I'm happy that that interest is newfound. So, you know, keep up the good work and the focus. One of the things that I want to kind of erase a little bit, and again, is not judging anybody's credibility or anything, but, you know, what would you say to some of the skeptics who say that you guys might fear the results of, you know, not going beyond concussions, but fear the results of, you know, the studies of head and spinal injuries, particularly as it pertains to football, since that's the cash cow. You know, some of the findings could ultimately lead to, you know, the loss of participants in football, and over the years it ultimately dries up as a sport, not only obviously in the NFL level, but on the college level. That's one question. And the other question is from a cardiac study. How does a young man like Isaiah Austin, how does he not be diagnosed with Marfan's for the 4 years he's at Baylor until he gets to the NBA? I mean, you know, this is obviously a Baylor situation, but nevertheless, with the NCAA overseeing, you know, this newfound interest in the health and well-being, is there a way that, you know, people like that don't fall through the cracks? I know 30, 40 years ago, the University of Maryland, a couple of my teammates and one not a teammate ultimately died because of Marfan's. No one really was able to diagnose it. And today, you know, their diagnosis capability is there. And I was just curious, how does Isaiah Austin fall through the cracks?
Well, thank you for your questions. For the first question, and I went through that complicated diagram a bit quickly, but at the executive committee level, There are three people representing three separate organizations. So myself from the NCAA, Colonel Dallas Hack from the Department of Defense, and Walter Korsas from the NIH. So there's no controlling vote or power in the executive committee. The NIH, from the very beginning, is exceedingly invested in this study. They haven't given any of the money for the startup, but the reason why they're part of the executive committee and one-third of it is that they believe that this is really the seminal study that's going to be the foundation for future concussion studies. By having a large group of people that are running this, the consortium, if you look at who those members are, they are the people that have been on the cutting edge of saying, stop. We have some issues here. Kevin Guskowitz, for example, who put his hand up when the NFL was producing its studies in the 90s and said, these studies make no sense. We have to do something about this. Tom McAllister, former chair of psychiatry at Indiana, or at Dartmouth, now at Indiana University, he's written some of the most compelling articles on the potential effects of long-term sequelae of brain injury using very complicated MRI techniques. Steve Broglio, if you look at all of the definitions of concussion that are out there, he is cited more than any other author as having produced the best evidence-based material out there. So I believe that the way it's set up, and I was very careful in setting it up so it was transparent, people saw where the voting came from, and people can look at who's running this, and then the scientific advisory panel, which has two student athletes on it as well. I'm hopeful that this won't be just considered another big pharma study. With regard to the cardiac issues, I can't answer your question, but I can say that's a serious concern. It brings me to two things. One is it's one of the compelling reasons we're having a cardiac task force. It's going to be a bloody war in there, I'm telling you. I've already told people that we're putting them in a room. I'm locking the room. I'm keeping the key. We have a dojo mat set up. I trained in Detroit in combat karate. And anyone who isn't able to see eye to eye, I'm inviting them to the dojo mat. It's going to be like that. But it brings to another issue, which is very serious, and that is our pre-participation examination in youth sport and in college. One of the other projects I'm working on, again, I didn't, for time's sake, didn't go into it, but we're trying to develop a universal pre-participation exam. The first part of it would mean that the student athlete, before even seeing the physician, would have to be with a smart application, and it would take 30 to 45 minutes. I've already taken a couple of versions of these because I'm testing them out. And you do that before you even see the physician. Some of the exams that are done, you have 100 kids, they haven't done their paperwork right. You know, hey, I'm starting tomorrow, I need my clearance. But that happens at the youth sport level too. I can't tell you how many friends of mine brought their kids and say, you know, Brian, can't you just, you know, give a little clearance letter for Steve? You know, I said, well, I'm a neurologist. He says, yeah, but you know, the doctor's booked for 3 weeks, he starts tomorrow. That's happening all over the place. A goal, a dream, a vision is that we universalize the pre-participation exam. We get it right at the college level. We extend it to the youth level. And then we figure out how to have a unique identifier. Easier said than done. We're working at this with the NIH and with others to follow kids progressively from youth all the way through college and beyond. That's not happening in our country. That's in part a product of our broken healthcare system. That happens in Scandinavian countries.
I'm on the board of the University of Michigan, and I'm well aware of what's going on in the concussive area and appreciate that and appreciate obviously being involved, and I'm familiar with Steve's work. My question goes to something else you raised, though, when you talked about binge alcohol and farming parties, also things that I'm familiar with both in the context of a student athlete and on the campus in general. And you talked about it, but you didn't necessarily say that anything is being done about it, or and that's my question. What is the how is the NCAA looking at those issues, which it seems that we are getting medical issues are coming to the forefront, and binge alcohol and the farming parties. We recently had student manager die from Adderall and alcohol, and it is something that not a lot of parents know about. It's something that not a lot of coaches know about. And how is the NCAA looking at those issues?
So here's our plan, and it's a progressive rollout. One of the issues is that the doping and recreational drugs, that's a legislative matter. So that's why we're actually having a retreat in December with competitive safeguards. But as we speak right now, we are piloting a alcohol, drug education, and doping program with 100 schools. It's funded in part by us and by the NIH. Not only are we doing this, and it's a great, I mean, I took it. So I always look at these things beforehand. I think it's a great program, but again, we're then assessing the efficacy of how this works. And then with 15 of the schools, we're attaching onto that a sexual abuse and sexual violence program. Why, you might ask, are we doing that with alcohol and drug abuse?
That's the linking piece to it.
Yeah, so some estimates it's at least 50%. I think it's closer to 90% of sexual violence happens under the influence of alcohol. So we're doing those two things. We have a choices program where we actually are going onto campus. That's a grant. It's about $500,000 a year. And it's a way of trying to teach the schools how to work with it. I don't think the NCAA is in the best position to be the police force on the campus. We have another program called NASPA. We have another one called INSTEP. So all of them are coming together while we're piloting the educational program. I don't know what the best answer is. I've actually written for several schools now their alcohol and drug testing protocol, and I believe very much in a biopsychosocial medical model. And that means that you try to come to an understanding of what's going on. But it's a monster. It really is a monster. Yeah. It must be every university president's worst nightmare. And so these are the pilots I'm doing. We're also addressing it in our mental health handbook, and because there are actually some wonderful chapters on alcohol and drug abuse, and these are the things we're going to be socializing and trying to figure out the best way to socialize it. But concussion, that was tough. I lose sleep over alcohol.
Yeah.
But so there are multiple projects going on right now at once.
Chuck?
I want to thank you so much for one of the best presentations I've ever sat through.
Thank you.
And I've sat through a lot of them over the years.
Chuck.
I have a couple of questions. One is, how do you manage to do so much with so little, I'm sure? And secondly, with regard to the issues which are not specifically related to athletics, the drug and alcohol abuse and sexual abuse, for instance, are you involving the college student health officers and the student affairs people from the universities? It seems to me that's the market and the focus that ought to be on. And then I have one last. How can we help?
Well, in terms of getting things done, it's a few principles. One is you have to be very disciplined. The other is I only eat carrots and broccoli. It's a secret. But most importantly, in all seriousness, the reason we're able to get things done is because there's just been such a collective openness for everyone wanting to work together. It's just been awesome. So that's the one thing. With regard to working with student healthcare services and student services, so we outline in our manual, and it's a very important part of our mental health handbook, and we actually suggest, because some of the big power schools, you know, they have their own sports psychologists and so forth, but at the very, very beginning of every season, every academic year, we actually believe, and we state this, and we put it out as a best practice in the handbook, that the student health services should be involved at the front end, and not just at the back end, and to figure out how they can become integrated. This is something that I think is evolving over time. In terms of how you can help, it's just, you know, in any way we can partner to get the word out that I think we're in exciting times, that we're deriving, getting the data now. We don't have all the answers, but even for you all to be able to say, even while we're awaiting the answers, we're still trying to do things. That's why we're coming up with these consensus statements. That's why we came up with the guidelines for concussion. And so it's just to help everyone else be aware of the truth out there. And the truth is, we are trying. The truth is, yes, we probably could be doing more or better. Everyone always can. But the truth is also, we don't have a lot of great scientific data to guide us, and so that's why we all need to come together collectively to develop the consensus, the best consensus on what we can do with existing information. The best thing you could do, if you can figure this out for me, is to convince every single member institution that we should be using the same centralized database. That's not happening. There are so many electronic medical records out there, and now people are developing their university systems. It can all be compatible with a centralized database. That's happening now with the National Catastrophic Center for Sport Injury Research. That's all going to data us. Our concussion study, it's all going to data us. We have about 20% of the schools going to data us. My goal is 100%.
Jerry, and then Sarah.
I would like to resurface what I think is another elephant in the room, and Lynn, I think, brought it up a little bit, and that's the relationship between football and concussions or other damages to the brain that result from rattling around inside of a solid skull and the effects that happen over time. So my question is assuming that these studies lead in the direction that I as a layman estimate that they might be leading, that there will be a conclusion that there is a fundamental incompatibility between a violent sport of football and health of the brain. What do you foresee then? Is this the death knell of football?
Well, I'll share with you one difference between football and another violent sport, boxing. In boxing, the goal is to cause neurological damage. So a knockout means that you are so concussed that you don't have the neuromuscular control to stand up. A technical knockout means you're so concussed you don't have the neuromuscular control to protect yourself. If you look at the first three sentences of the rules of football for the NCAA, the first sentence is, football is an aggressive, rugged contact sport. The second sentence says, there is no place in the sport of football for deliberately inflicting harm on another. The third sentence says that there's no place in the sport of football for a coach to allow that. Now, ultimately, are we going to come to a place where it's such an aggressive contact, rugged sport that even if we enforce all the rules and make the rules better, it's incompatible with brain health? I don't know. I can tell you that there are many scientists who believe that that's not the case. There are many who believe it is the case. I think we need to derive the data from that. But the other thing we don't understand is we have never validated a return to play protocol. So if someone is concussed, when is the best time for that person to return to play? We have no data on that. We're using rat data, and we're extrapolating from that. The other issue is that I'm hopeful with the biosensor data that we're getting that we're not just going to be talking about concussion but the subconcussive impacts. And I have a feeling that what's going to be evolving over time is that we're going to really have a very sophisticated way of saying, okay, you are reaching a biomechanical threshold. No contact for the next week or two. Just like we're now getting great data from the Catapult GPS system, and a couple of schools are actually starting to perfect that in terms of recovery. I think the sensors, once we get that down, are going to tell us an awful lot. And then it's going to bring us to a place of what we call periodization in football, meaning how much contact can you have, how much time do you need to step back, because it really is, I'm very concerned also in wrestling, I'm concerned especially in women's ice hockey. They all pose a risk. I do know that no matter how safe we make any of these sports, there's going to be a 10% risk of injury or concussion. The question is concussion something like other injuries that can be managed properly and one can actually have a safe and well brain following that? Or are there even interventions? And I believe this is possible because if we look at brain plasticity, we've never exploited what that really is all about. Just as you can have a back injury and 20 years later, even though the tissues haven't repaired what is wrong with the back, you have a herniated disc, it never comes back. But you fundamentally can have a stronger back if you do everything right. The question is, can you have a stronger brain even after a concussion? That's not even been explored in science. So I'm, as a scientist, I'm putting this all out there. I think we have to be extraordinarily vigilant with our rules and as the new data come in with how we're utilizing that and understanding it. The reason why I'm a little hopeful is because we're doing the biosensor data in year one and we're doing it with very advanced MRI imaging and others. So I think we're going to start getting these answers. I don't know what they'll be, though.
Sarah?
Thank you again for your remarks. Listening to you speak, it sounds like there's been obviously an emphasis on prevention, so starting with some of the youth sports and then moving into intercollegiate athletics. I think a question now for today's graduating athletes is what is the role of the NCAA for those who may have not sort of shown symptoms yet, but are sort of moving in that direction, or might 10 years from now show symptoms from their activity as an intercollegiate athlete. So what is the NCAA thinking about with respect to that, and is there a role, you know, even from a financial support or a medical service sort of provision for some of those athletes who might experience some of these issues down the road?
Yeah, so a couple things have happened. One is we actually substantially changed the catastrophic injury policy. You know, it used to be, I don't know, the numbers were lower, and now they're really, really quite high, and so they would fully support someone. But also, if you saw in the news, and this has to go through the approval process, but in the concussion lawsuit, the mediation. So part of that is that anyone past or present who has a concussion, that they actually, we are setting up regionally places where they can be followed, or they can be followed indefinitely. And that's going to be overseen by an advisory panel. I will be part of that, but I'm certainly not going to be the majority vote. It's really going to be by independent parties who are seeing the best way to roll that out. And so that sort of safeguard in terms of anyone who's had a concussion and wants to be part of that program, that's a monitoring program that goes on indefinitely.
Yes.
Are you and your organization doing anything with regard to the concern some of us have about insurance that will cover the athlete's well-being in relation to injuries which occurred during his period as an athlete?
Yeah, so that's also something that's addressed. Any student athlete must have health insurance. So the question is who does the insuring? And in our great country, who mandates that you have insurance? And that's a whole other discussion. One hopeful thing is that through the Affordable Care Act, that everyone is going to be covered. The member institutions have to figure out a way to cover the student athletes, and then the NCAA does back that up. And so that is something. It's very active in its discussion phase. I think we're probably going to have a very good sense within the next year of how this is definitively going to play out. But that also is a priority, that anyone who suffers an injury is covered for that injury, and they're covered for life for that injury.
Bill?
Well, I was trying to not say much at this time because I think your presentation was excellent, and I appreciate it. But I've got a three-year-old grandson and a six-year-old grandson and a 12-year-old granddaughter. And I had three daughters, and I always said if they wanted to play sports, it would be fine. But increasingly, I've come to the point where I'm concerned about my three-year-old grandson, who's about 2.5 feet tall, but he weighs 47 pounds. And a six-year-old grandson, who's about almost 4 feet tall and weighs about 100 pounds. And the fact that my granddaughter is almost 5'9", and while she doesn't play sports, she's very athletic. And the fact that they are that young and they are just going to get bigger, faster, and stronger, and that the collisions are going to be more violent, the speeds of whatever game they play, soccer, ice hockey, whatever it might be, is going to increase. And yet, I don't see a way for when they have that contact, either with another person or with an object, that there's going to be a way to keep that concussion or that injury from happening. I just don't see it. And so it raises a question about rethinking competition in sport. And this is even more fundamental than whether football will exist, but contact sports in general, because of the size and speed of the athletes and the way the games are coached. And it's not necessarily a question, but it's a concern that I have as I think about the future of intercollegiate athletics and particularly youth sports. I watched Friday Night Tykes, and I just cringed at the idea of one of my two grandsons being coached by people like that.
Well, I'll try to answer that in two ways. I'll tell you what I told my six-year-old granddaughter, when she said, "Grandpapa, what should I do when I grow up?" I said, "You should be like me. You should play piano and play tennis." But as an NCAA spokesperson, I don't think I should be saying that, right? But I'll tell you, I've had more injuries in tennis than any other sport, and I played every sport. But let's get back to the real issue. I think we all have to take a giant step back and philosophically say, why should we play sport? Why not just have everyone exercise? We know the benefits of exercise, cognitively, physically, socially. Why play sport? Because no matter how safe we make sport, I guarantee you there will be a 10% risk of some type of injury, including concussion. The question is, if you have a concussion and it's managed properly, does that mean that your career or your life is over? I don't believe so. But I don't think things have been managed correctly. I think concussion is actually bringing us to a place of safety in sport because we finally said enough is enough. Let's get the data. Let's do things right. But getting back to why play sport, I do have my own bias. Because sport, unlike exercise, takes you to a place where you go right to the edge of the cliff. And it's at the edge of the cliff where you come to understand your creative soul. You learn how to fall down. You learn how to pick yourself up. You learn how to lose with grace. You learn how to win with grace. Or you can learn how to be a cheater, a sneak. You can learn all of these things. In team sport, you learn things that you never learn in other aspects of life. I will tell you that for the first most important job of my life, when I interviewed for my neurology residency with Dr. Fred Plum at Cornell Medical College, and he was at the time considered the fiercest, most ferocious, and most brilliant neurologist in the country. And all of the people interviewing there were PhD, you know, they were MD, PhDs, and I was, you know, just a MD kind of guy. You know, I was reasonably smart. He interviewed me. The first 5 minutes, he just kind of picked my brain. He saw that, you know, I was okay in smarts. He spent the rest of the hour asking me about my training regimen, about my experience in sport, about my experience playing Junior Davis Cup, about my experience in doubles versus singles and team competition. And at the end of it, he said, "Brian, we need someone like you in our program. We need an athlete. We need someone with discipline. We need someone who has pushed himself to the edge and has figured out how to survive and continue to make himself better. That is sport. It is extraordinary. But we got to get it right." And so that's why we're here today. I believe that's why they created the position of chief medical officer. We have to collectively figure out how to get it right and bring sport back to that extraordinary place where you find out where your creative soul is within your mind and your body. That's sport.
Brian, I have a question, and unfortunately we're going to have to wrap up this session, but actually two questions. When I think back over my life as a student athlete, when I was growing up, I played a lot of sports. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore, that young people, they at a very young age, get committed to a particular sport, and so that's all they do. And you made some fleeting reference to that, but are there issues that you see associated with that model that are of concern about the development of student athletes? And the second question I have is, you know, the research you're doing is so impressive and is being done in such a rigorous way, and you're going to reach very profound conclusions from this research. That seems clear to me. Do you foresee this research leading to standards of behavior and practice that would become the expectation, the policy across the NCAA?
Yeah, so first question, and that's that two-year early specialization, right? Overuse injury task force. So the last thing I did in my official position as chief medical officer for the U.S. Tennis Association, I wrote a book called Positioning Youth Tennis for Success. and it was based on a summit where we had USA Hockey, USA Swimming, Baseball, Tennis. We had world experts, and we looked at all of the data on early specialization, and it's a disaster. It's a disaster, early specialization. And for all of the, because what happens is you develop as a player and not as an athlete. You don't have athleticism, the ABCs of athleticism, agility, balance, coordination, speed, stamina, strength. You don't do that if you're just pitching at a young age. And so, and again, the injuries are profound. And so that's very much part of this task force. It's one of the central tenets of the task force. With regard to, say, the concussion study, so what we anticipate, and the way the data analysis is set up, this is real-time data analysis, I think two things are going to happen. One is, I'm hopeful that a couple things are going to happen. One is that we're going to have semi-autonomous regional hubs that are going to use the exact same protocol we're using, and that's going to catch on and become the norm for how we should be addressing concussion for every sport. That's a hope, but also as we analyze the data real time, we put that out there, I think that's going to shift. It's going to lead to, well, possibly some very difficult decisions. It's certainly going to lead to rules changes, I believe. I think it's going to lead, more importantly, to practice changes. I will say one thing, again, for lack of time, I didn't talk about it, but the NCAA Concussion Task Force, after the Safety in Football Summit, we went to address how should we be practicing in ice hockey and wrestling and soccer and lacrosse. You know what we came up with? We shrugged our shoulders. We have no idea. Yeah, we can put out guidelines, but the data are so limited. So one thing we're doing in November, we're having a soccer summit, which I'm really excited about. And it's looking at the sport of soccer, maybe as a template for other sports, to stretch out the schedule, which may seem, oh, goodness gracious, now you're making the season longer. But if you do it right, you don't cram everything into the spring where you take kids out of the classroom, you have them doing four games in 2 days, and you have as the basis what's called periodization, which means that for every amount of overreaching, there's recovery. So you never move into the place of overtraining, and that you have mandatory time off. Time off. Not time off to go drinking. Time off to have time off. So we'll see what happens with soccer. The USTA is moving a new facility to Lake Nona in Orlando. They're going to have 100 courts. I was, you know, they picked my brain about that all weekend. Rather, I just wanted to watch tennis, you know, but I think they have an opportunity to make tennis a model sport. You look at the junior schedule in tennis, it's a disaster. But it's no different than all the youth sports. So we have a real problem. But I have some ideas which I'm hoping will catch on.
Well, Brian, I can just sense from my colleagues great admiration and appreciation for the phenomenal work you do. Chuck raised the right question. We want to be helpful to you. The issues you've raised are coming front and center on our agenda. We expect to continue to interact with you and be as helpful as we can as you move this very, very important work forward. So let me ask my colleagues to express our appreciation.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. For more information on the Knight Commission, please visit knightcommission.org.